Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Hey, welcome to I Foresee Trouble with Dalian Wallace. Today's episode, we're going to talk a bit about UAMs. You'll find out about what that is at the end of the episode. A bit on Europol, and of course, we can't help but talk about something on foreign affairs. And today we'll talk a little bit about Somalia. But first, we have to talk about our country of the week. Un paese molto, molto importante, molto speciale per noi.
Italia!
Italia! So,
and it was very good to be in the Olympic Stadium last weekend for the opening game of the European Championships, to see Italy put manners on Turkey, beating them 3-0, played really well. And I have to say now, they were pretty good last night too. They beat Switzerland 3-0 last night, and they're good to watch.
But are they going to win it?
Listen, the French are the best team in it, and there's a number of teams that could win it, right? But in actual fight, the Italians would be difficult to beat, they will. And there's a lovely swagger to them. They seem to be in a good place mentally, but there's no doubt about it, but the French have more quality than anybody. And the France-Germany game the other night was a superb game. Mm. And the Germans were very good too.
Yeah.
A really good German side. Given that we've seen most of those Germans before, but they played really well. But the French are that bit better than them.
We're all rooting for Italy, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm looking forward to be back in Rome this Sunday night for the Italia-Wales game. I think the people at home would be very disappointed if I were to neglect my passion for football just because of the European Parliament. I think that would be going a bit too far.
Well, I think it's very important that they should know that your loyalty to football doesn't just rest with Italy, that of course you were in Bucharest as well to cheer on Macedonia against Austria, and certainly nobody would blame you for that. And that you are following the tournament in its entirety. And I mean, joking aside, actually, it's an example of how safe travel is possible. And when you look at aviation being on its knees at home, and the pilots and crew having to again protest outside the Dáil this week for sense to prevail in terms of antigen testing, and the complete chaos between the health advice from NPHET in Ireland and everything else that's been done in Europe. I mean, you've led a normal life, if you like, Mick, in terms of your normal football life. Whenever the European Championships come in, you've safely travelled and all the rest, and yet people in Ireland can't even leave the country. It's mad, you
and
know.
What's it like in the stadiums as well? Because they're all, of course, less people in them, except maybe in the Hungary match. That one looked a bit full. But
the general rule is that it's 25%. Budapest in Hungary is 100% capacity. They're letting everybody in. I see that for London, for the two semi-finals and the final, I think they're going to let in about 45% now. To the bottom. But the atmosphere in Rome and in Bucharest was powerful, given that there's only a quarter of the people in there. First of all, in terms of Bucharest, I made no bones about making public that I was shouting for Macedonia, despite the fact that they lost. But when Palestine were being bombed and 66 children being killed by the Israeli Defence Forces, the Austrian government flew the Israeli flag over government buildings, which was an incredible thing to do. But it was easy to sell for Macedonia. But anyway, Austria won. But in terms of a normal football life, I've obviously got a great passion for the Wexford Utes, and it's just impossible to go home and back for games. It's been so difficult getting to Ireland and back.
Yeah.
And I haven't been going to Ireland much because of the restrictions. And so I've actually seen very, very little of the Wexford youths in the last year. Very little. Anyway.
I mean, I think it's worth saying, like, because, I mean, I was home for the first time since Christmas because we've had our two vaccines now and all the rest of it. But, you know, to explain to people at home that normal, safe travel is happening all over Europe, yeah. And Ireland is an outlier in that. And when you saw the announcements over the weekend of the closure of Stobart Air with the loss of 480 aviation jobs, mm-hmm. devastating. Pilots, crew, ground staff who had spent 16 months in financial, you know, disaster, but hanging on there. And then overnight, the ground is pulled from under it. And they're the operator that do all the regional routes to the UK and in within Ireland for Aer Lingus, just gone. And I mean, it's absolutely linked. I mean, there was a really, I found a bit sickening that, you know, we had Aer Lingus's base closing in Shannon, but Ryanair are opening up new bases in Shannon. Mm. So there will be a recovery coming, but what type of recovery and for who is being dictated by the Irish government, and they are facilitating a race to the bottom in terms of workers' wages and conditions, and it's scary. And they've actually added to the job losses in the sector in Ireland because of their really ultra-caution, which is not necessary.
And their ultra-caution is directly linked to the fact that they've made a basic case of our health service in the last 10-15 years, and they have decimated the health service. Even though we might have a normal spend in terms of average in Europe, we spend more on the bureaucratic end of it and management than anyone else in Europe for percentage wise. We're spending less on frontline staff where you should be spending it. And then once the problem comes along like COVID, it was reeking under the pressure, and they were afraid of their life, that the system would be even worse exposed and that they wouldn't be able to cope. And that's one of the main reasons why restrictions, despite the numbers in Ireland being way below the European average in terms of cases and deaths, but the restrictions in Ireland have been one of the more draconian.
Yeah. And it's funny, like, but those at the helm of that health service, which you've described very well, are now the ones basically running the country. I mean, they're unelected. Like, we've had huge health scandals in our recent past in terms of, you know, maternal deaths, the cervical cancer scandal and so on. And many of these people now who are calling the shots and who are kind of like the basically running the country are the ones who stood over those crises as well. And there doesn't seem to be any joining of the dots being done anywhere. Like, you know, it's actually, and if anybody says that, of course, they're, you know, called a pariah or somebody who's trying to jeopardize public health or something. It's ludicrous.
It's interesting because the media haven't really questioned it either. But when in the history of the state before did the elected people in power decide to give away their authority and allow us others to make the decisions? Because that's what's happened this time. Mm. And it's like to say, here, it was like as if they passed the ball to him and say, you carry the ball. We're afraid we'll do something wrong. We're afraid it'll all go tits up. So we let the health service take the hit for us. So the health service probably said, well, you know what now? If we're going to carry the ball, we'll carry it our way. And you can look forward to pretty severe restrictions from our end.
Yeah. And, you know, we hope to be able to get back to Ireland at some stage, maybe at the end of the summer. It'd be nice to see home again. I haven't been back since Christmas. So.
Yeah. Oh, look, there was a bit of a pickup. And, you know, the trial sporting events, music events, where they had some crowds in. The opening up of outdoor dining was great, even though, like, outdoor dining in Ireland isn't as nice as outdoor dining in Italy with the weather. But
or Brussels.
Or Brussels even, great, the weather's been great in Brussels. But look, there was a bit of a pick-me-up, which is important because the damage to people's mental health is severe.
And I was surprised that, I mean, Dublin was to host three of the European Championships games, but they would have been obliged to let 25% of the people in. And I think they should have. I think it was a big mistake. And I think it would have given the country a real lift, even though, unfortunately, Ireland didn't make the tournament final stages. I think it would have given the city, Dublin in particular, and the people in the country as well, people would have enjoyed the games being played in Dublin. Mm. And listen, letting one in four of the people into a stadium isn't madness. And I've been in two of the stadiums, and it would handle really well in both stadiums, and I wouldn't see a big problem with it. And I think it was a big disappointment that the Irish government decided to block it.
Yeah. Anyway, today we need to go on to our country of the week, which is Italy. So tell us about Italy. It's obviously one of the bigger players here anyway in the European Parliament. We're talking about impact. Tell us a bit about the MEPs here. Walk us through the groups. Go on.
Well, I'll leave the broader points about Italy for Mick. I'll maybe talk about the ones here. We've 73 Italian MEPs, which is a lot. They got three extra from Brexit. Again, this is an interesting one in that the big groups in the parliament aren't really represented by Italian voters. So we have a situation where the EPP group, which is the biggest group that Fine Gael are in, and the Renew group that Fianna Fáil are in, between the two of them, they've hardly any members in them, which is really interesting. There was no Italians in Renew at all until one fella got in on one of the Brexit seats. But the biggest group are the Liga. They're in the ID group, which is seen as the far right group in the parliament. They have the biggest influence from Italy. The next biggest is on eight, they have 29 MEPs, which is obviously huge. More than a third of the Italian MEPs came from that group, which gives you an indication of the polarisation of society there. Second in the parliament were the S&Ds, very wimpy, not really impressive at all, 18 of them. You had the Five Star Movement, which was the sort of seen as the sort of bottom-up popular sort of party, not right nor left. It kind of came out of the crisis and that. To be honest, it's lost its way an awful lot and it's gone really downhill. It had 15 people elected, but four of them defected to the Greens recently, and they're totally chaotic and they're not aligned in any group. And then you have the Fratelli Italia. They're in the ECR group. They're actually back in Italy at the moment now. They were the only group who objected to the appointment of Draghi as president, and they're actually growing. They're actually the second biggest group back home in Italy. So you have the Liga, Fratelli Italia, so both right-wing groups dominating. Third up then is the more social democracy, and then the five-star movement.
It's quite a liberal kind of Social Democrat Party,
So I think that really reflects the difference of Italy. That's quite a different makeup. Very interesting. There's no Greens elected in Italy as well. And that's not that they don't care about the environment, because actually in terms of agriculture and all of that, they're actually very good. They'd probably be ahead of the curve, but it reflects that Italians don't really go for that sort of lily-livered sort of middle-of-the-road kind of green types. Four did defect from the five stars in there, but it's not something that is naturally Italian. It's not
kind of
Greek.
A Southern Europe Mediterranean thing as well. There's not a green movement for, like, political kind of. They're more ideological, I guess, in their voting, and they don't have this kind of liberal kind of non-defined kind of green.
It's the same thing
movement
as replicated in Greece. There's no real Greens.
Spain,
in Portugal, these areas, they don't have Greens. That environmental vote tends to be with the left or, the alternative, generally speaking. So it's more of a kind of a class history, and obviously Italy has an incredibly impressive and class history. Obviously David Sassoli, the president of the parliament, comes from Italy.
And the previous president as well. So they've had the parliament presidency for a while, Antonio Tajani. So,
have you come across any impressive ones?
Not a lot, no. Yeah. It's funny now, but if you're in Italy, right, they would tell you that that politics is particularly dysfunctional in Italy. And now, we would probably argue that politics is pretty dysfunctional everywhere. But I would say that the Italians in particular are incredibly cynical today about politics, and they would not feel well served by their elected representatives. And I would detect, just from the Italians that I know, that I encounter in Italy, I would detect a higher level of cynicism than normal, right? Now, Italy, you might say, well, why is that? Well, in many ways, Italy is not well organised. In many ways, the EU doesn't suit Italy. And you know, I might say, well, why don't you? I was just reading one statistic there where it says the average industrial company in Italy today has less than 50 workers. And business, whether it's manufacturing or otherwise, is predominantly family orientated, and which is a great thing, right? But it meant that an awful lot of Italy's industry stayed small and it didn't really buy into globalization. And the European Union is tailor-made for globalization. It was with all its neoliberal trade deals, its very neoliberal nature. And Italy hasn't really fitted into that very well. And there's always been talks of, oh, Italy might leave. And there's, if there was a vote in Italy today as to whether they should leave or not, well, I can tell you, before they got a big handout of the COVID money, I'd say 75% of them would have voted for leave. But yeah, at any stage in the last 20 years, a vote in Italy, I'd say, would have shown probably more than half would be up for leaving, which, as we know, if you had the same in Ireland, 9 out of 10 in Ireland would probably vote to stay, right? Well, we won't get into that. We've discussed that before. But Italy, and listen, there's been a lot of problems in how things are done there. It's very bureaucratic, which is soul destroying for people trying to do things. They would probably have, they have a high tax rate as well, right? Which is a good thing in the sense that they have great public services and they have great pension schemes in comparison to, we'll say, our own, right? Corporation tax is double ours, almost. It's 24%. I'd much rather get sick in Italy than get sick in Ireland from a point of view of the health service that would be available to you. But then on the other side of it, Italy is a massive producer of food, and of all the countries that we have dealt with so far that we've covered in our podcast, Italy agriculture is actually a bigger proportion of their GDP than in any of the others that we've discussed yet. And it's the largest producer in the world for wine today. It surpassed the French. Mm-hmm. It's the largest producer of vegetables and fruit and rice in the whole of Europe. I mean, you might say rice. I mean, people might think, well, God, people mightn't realise that rice was grown in Europe at all. But that's all grown in the north along the Lombardia plain. And if you're ever driving through Lombardia, if you're driving south from Milan, or if you're even driving from Turin to Milan, and if you're near the River Po at all, right, there's absolute miles and miles of rice fields, because you see the water standing in the fields. So, and it's risotto they grow, right? Not the rice, the normal rice that people abuse it up, but risotto is obviously a famous Italian dish, and they grow amazing risotto, and obviously it's very popular in northern Italy. The wine is obviously of particular interest to me for a number of reasons. And I should say that it's phenomenal how much of a move there's been towards the production of bio wine in Italy in the last few years. And there's a big move away from using chemicals in the sprays and that kind of thing, which is a great thing. And the Italians are so passionate about the production of wine, and they're so serious about it. It means so much to them. I always used to say,
in general, probably.
I remember I was doing, I did wine tastings when we opened the wine bars at home first, right? And I used to get wine producers over and I'd introduce them before they start talking about their wines, and they'd open all their wines and they'd talk about each of them. And we used to get one of the Italians working in some of the bars to translate if they didn't speak English, whatever. And when I'd be introducing them, I used to always say, we always only brought over real good producers. And I said, now, they said, this is actually 100% true, I said. But I said, Italian wine producers would cheat on their wives before they cheat in the way they make the wine. I said, they're pretty serious about how they make their wine.
You're saying they're not serious about their women?
Oh, they're very, very serious about women too.
Then, right, okay. But no, I mean,
In fact, I think they're very fond of them.
I think they are. I think you're right.
Wouldn't blame them.
But I think, you know, it is interesting when you look at the geography of it, and you, when you look at, you see the types of people who were returned to the Parliament. I mean, that geography where traditionally industry was in the north of the country and the south was more rural and more poor. But actually, the Liga, which were, you know, predominantly from the north in earlier times, have actually swept the boards, and they kind of tapped into that point you were making about, I suppose, anti-EU sentiment. Do you know what I mean? That, and the League have very much campaigned sort of against the EU, particularly against what they would call the migration agenda. They would have been quite anti-migrant and so on. Some of it legitimate in the sense of you had the sort of affluent northern European nations of the Dutch and the French, etc., lecturing Italy about, you know, leaving refugees behind. But they weren't taking any and they weren't landing on their shores. But obviously it was completely handled in a very racist and bad way by Italy as well. But, you know, they've jumped ship now. And the Liga then supported Draghi and kind of rode in behind him in terms of after the pandemic. So it is interesting how they are going to do after that. You know
it's
what I mean?
It's a party kind of always in flux because it started off as a regionalist northern protectionist kind of area party to express those interests, like what we have kind of in Belgium. They wanted secession from Italy as well. And then with the migrant crisis, we just saw Italy become symptomatic, basically, of the problems of the EU and leading to the far right, huge surge in Italy, but also the change of Lega becoming a nationalist party. So they're using the Italian flag all the time now, not provincial ones. They have the second highest vote in Sicily. Like, this is not the north of Italy at all. So they've completely changed as a party, kind of rallied around migration, where there was huge problems politically, and there was huge sentiment that they just whipped up as well. And
it's funny because one of the people would say in that group, the ID group, which is known as the far right group there, what some of the other people in the far right, sort of from Germany and France, would say that the Italians in it, who are the biggest group in it, actually don't really have an ideology. And I think that's true as well. I think they've found different ways of trying to express that frustration whereby their needs aren't being met by the way in which society is organised in Italy or organised in the EU. And I suppose it, that's kind of reflected by the fact that there's a whole number of MEPs in the different groups who are actually okay. Like, and you know, I would work, the person I would work closest with in terms of the transport committee, for example, is an Italian from the ID far right Liga group, because he's actually very good on kind of workers' rights and stuff like that, and on protecting jobs in Europe and that kind of thing. So it is a kind of a confused sort of history.
And then they're against the EU, completely against the EU, but then with the handout of money, they were all in favour of that. So it's a mixed bag as well. On environment as well, one of your friends, Mick, Silvia Sardone, is always speaking in the environment committee. She doesn't believe in climate change, though, which is kind of a problem.
Yeah, she's from Milan, and she's a tough yoke now. But I should say that two Italians that I've met, and they've come from, they're in right-wing parties here, but Pietro Fiocchi and also Marco Campanese, right?
Campomanosi.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
They're two lovely fellas, right? They're really nice. And obviously, Massimo Castaldo is the leader of the Five Star here. Is a very nice guy. But the point you were making, Damien, about the transformation in Liga in Italy, it's completely reflected in the change of name, because they went from Liga Nord, which is exactly that Udinese Friuli region, to Liga, meaning and looking to capture the support of a whole country. But I think that, I mean, Liga are kind of a new entity, and they've grown dramatically, obviously, over the last few years in Italy. So the EU is a bit new to them as well. And while they were anti-EU, I think when they eventually found themselves in Brussels, they were probably pleasantly surprised to find that, in actual fact, the EU is as right-wing as themselves in general.
So, and
I think it's why, was one of the reasons why the Liga are starting to warm to the place, because they have plenty of like-minded souls running around these corridors.
Yeah. So you have them as this huge component of the Italian delegation. You said the Five Star, who are equally lost ideologically, they've completely lost momentum and energy, and they don't know what they stand for. some good people in it, though. But then we're, the PD, the Partido Democratico, is probably another weird one because they're in the S&D group, the Socialists and Democrats, but they're modeled, their party that's modeled on the American Democratic Party, which just... You don't even know, need to go any further than that to explain how bad that is.
There's weird people in it. Like,
they're,
you know,
terrible. I mean, Paulo de Castro is horrendously destroying the CAP. They have all these people. They're extremely actually right wing. They're in this left group, but it doesn't really make sense. So there's a lot of confusion in Italian politics and things aren't really lining up. And lots of movement.
Of course,
there's the girl that I encounter a lot. And she's very pleasant and all, right? Cinzia Bonfrisco. Right. Well, my God, she is so right-wing.
Yeah.
And she buys into the anti-Chinese and anti-Russian rhetoric morning, noon and night. Oh, God, she's a queer one.
Most of the Italians are pretty anti-Chinese. And, of course, they're all over Libya like a rash as well. Like, that's one of their favourites is, you know, getting in on the Libyan act. And, of course, your old friend Silvio Berlusconi, never been seen since the day, well, after the day he was elected. It hasn't been, I don't think he's voted in anything.
No, true, yeah. No. So he got voted,
I'm sure Silvio has probably other fish to fry.
Must have. We also not frying them here anyway, that's for sure.
We also have Alessandra Mussolini, so I'll let you guess who she's related to. That also explains to you a little bit about Italian politics, about how important a name is. She's the granddaughter of Benito Mussolini.
Where is she? Do we start? Never heard of her.
I don't know if she's still elected, actually.
No,
but
there's
she was
none of them there,
elected, and she was in the right wing group and the
she
ECR
was,
one, the Fratelli d'Italia.
You know, because
she might have been replaced.
She was,
though,
when we came first, she was there, yeah.
But that's like you wouldn't hear of any Francos representing Spain or anything.
Well,
or
I'll tell you what now. there's I'd challenge that. I would, right. There's some serious right-wingers from Spain here, and I would say that Franco is alive and well in terms of...
I mean, and the same with the Germans.
There is no comparison. I mean, the Liga are not in the same league at all in terms of Vox in Spain, who are totally fascist, I would say, at this stage. Alternative for Deutschland are pretty much in that ilk.
Yeah.
The Liga isn't like that, so it is a kind of a confused sort of a thing. But yeah, mad stuff. Yeah. But I mean, we should talk about the left as well, because there's nobody in the left group, and there used to be.
Exactly.
I mean, there was a really strong communist bloc in Italy's history, a very radical history around the big car factories and Italy in general. A huge struggle. And up until recently, they had a number in the left group, including the daughter of Altiero Spinelli, who was one of the big headbutt cats here in the EU. We're in his building, actually.
Yeah, that's the building is named after him.
But they had no seats after the last election.
So they did
again.
Terrible, And it's because when election time, it really comes down to migration. That's the political... Yeah. It completely takes all the oxygen in debate at election time in Italy. And gets people voting, which is really sad. But as you said, Italy used to have a really strong left. The communists used to be a whole third of the representatives only a few decades ago. And now it's complete collapse and fragmentation. There's a few different left parties, but nothing really standing out. And people then think the PD is the left party when, as we said, it's really the farthest thing from a left party
shocking,
we could talk about.
But make the Labour Party look good nearly.
Now that we've done so much giving out about this wonderful country... we have to say some positive things about it, because you know what? I mean, just aside from the politics, right? It is such a wonderful place to go. And the people, I really enjoy the Italians. I enjoy their food. I enjoy their wine. I've enjoyed female company a lot down there. I have met and male as well.
That's gas.
It's just a really warm-hearted place.
Warm-hearted, isn't
it? It is. And obviously, I'm very fond of the football, and there's no place better than being in a football stadium in Italy, where the atmosphere is second to none.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful place to be. And obviously, I'm a Torino fan, first off, and... It's such a wonderful club to be have anything to do with. I really, really enjoyed very much, and the Torino's a beautiful city as well. But
I did my Erasmus in Bologna, so that's my city. I'm very close to it, and Italy's by far my favourite country as well. Very, very close
relations. Absolutely, me too.
To
and in fairness, we've said it to the Italians here. It is the best country in Europe for so many different reasons, I think, you know, and yeah, more power to them in that. So I don't think we've been negative about them at all. We were kind of saying their presence here isn't great, but it's actually
true. Yeah, there's not so many heavy hitters, or else yeah, they kind of like to frustrate things, because Lega's agenda here is kind of to frustrate a few things rather than do things, do you know. So that's
they're not
it,
really
basically.
Present here, like, you know. Yeah.
When we had Matteo Salvini, he was here. He's the leader of Lega. He used to be the Minister for Interior in Italy. People probably know him at home for his anti-migrant rhetoric. He was a big shot here for many years, and he wasn't turning up to things. But when he was speaking at plenary debates or whatever, he was the Nigel Farage equivalent. So
I should add that two of my sisters left Ireland to go work in Italy when they were very young. Kay went first, and followed a couple of years later by maids. Mary, and Maids has been there now, I think, full time since 85. Kay didn't stay as long, but the two of them have obviously enjoyed it enough to spend a lot of their lives there. So it's been.
Would we be got biased in giving a rating to Italy? But we have to think about what we've been rating on the quality of or the impact in the European Parliament, really. So what are we giving out of 10 for that?
Hold on a minute now. I mean, you're saying when we've talked about impact,
we've kind
right?
of changed this. We haven't been very consistent.
We've all made it very clear that Italy is our favourite country in the whole of Europe, probably the world. But actually, in terms of the European Parliament, I think you couldn't really give them more than 5. And I'm doing that because there's some really nice, good people. And some of them are in the right groups, the likes of Marco Campomanosi and others who do interact well, who are nice people and stuff. So, yeah, but they're not. They're not
no left representation at all.
Yeah,
so
they're not intervening really here.
No one, unfortunately.
And the guy in ECR, right, which is one of the most conservative groups here, although it's debatable which is the most conservative. I mean, Renew can be more conservative than ECR on foreign affairs sometimes, but Pietro Fiocchi, he's actually good on environment, and he's not. I tell you what, now
he knows his stuff, but he's very right wing politics.
For someone from the right, I see him saying more positive things than most. Right, I'm not saying, Damien, that he's in the same school of thought on environment as your good
anything
self.
But.
Right? But he's not bad. And he's actually...
And they're all nice.
Hold on a minute.
Nice,
and nice he's actually involved in cleaning up rivers in Piemonte at the moment. I mean, listen, come on. Credit's given some credit, like, you know. But listen, in terms of rating a country, I do recall rating some countries in here. And we weren't just talking about impact on the European
Parliament. What else then?
Parliament.
Go on.
We talked about other things too.
No, because we have to be nice about it.
We didn't because, you know, and we made specifically the points. I mean, I can't remember. I gave Germany a really high mark, and it wasn't because we liked them or anything. It was because of the impact and the influence that they've had, you know.
Yeah.
Well, they're the big player. Which we'll all give our own mark for them. Are you getting them, player?
For impact here, about 5.
Yeah, I'm giving 5 as well, because there's a few heads who do some good work. So, yeah.
Okay, for impact in the European Parliament, I'm going to give them a 3, but I'm going to give them a 10 for everything else.
Oh, yeah. we'll all give them a 10 for everything else.
And a whole other score sheet, 10, absolutely.
And it would be so wonderful to see them have a great European Championships.
Yeah,
they've started well.
Come on.
And for them to win it would just be unreal. It would be just so good.
Let's talk about a few other things that were happening this week. We're scratching our heads there, Claire, about what is UAM and what is happening in this committee during the week.
It's utterly demoralising. We were at the Transport Committee yesterday, and we had a presentation from the head of the European Aviation Safety Authority, EASA, and he was presenting a report on unmanned aerial mobility and the societal acceptance of same. Now, you know, what is that about? Like, it's just utterly ridiculous. So against the backdrop of the aviation industry being on its knees, obviously atypical employment, the race to the bottom, bogus self-employment predominating in the sector before COVID, post-COVID, the low-cost carriers positioning themselves to move in even for the kill. So rather than the commission dealing with those conditions, which obviously have a big impact on safety, not to mind the welfare of crew and pilots. Rather than addressing that now, they're delaying addressing those issues, which is kind of allowing, I suppose, that type of precarious employment to prevail. So you think that the head of the safety organisation might be trying to address that, including all the job losses and everything? No. Mm. They did a study on this. This is about basically drones. And would people like to see now, as a way of dealing with traffic congestion, drones instead? And they were doing a survey amongst people and trying to promote this idea that in 2 or 3 years' time, our cities are going to be dominated by these unmanned drones collecting parcels and, you know, dealing with emergencies. So you would have these vertical takeoff and landing stations everywhere around our cities, allegedly, where people would jump into a sort of a private air taxi with no pilot in it and go from one part of, say, you know, Dublin out to Dublin Airport or whatever. Now, for God's sake, like, who is going to... The idea that this is going to be an accessible or desirable mode of transport into the future is just an absolute joke. And that's what our committee was spending its time dealing with yesterday. I mean, yeah. Ridiculous. On one level, you say, well, that sounds nice, the idea of sending your parcel. And there are deliveries being done like that. But are we going to now replace the poor gig economy, super exploited van driver with an unmanned drone now doing his job and whizzing past people's bedroom at night, driving them all mad with the noise of the stupid thing? I mean, actually, what they should be doing is designing our cities to ensure pedestrian and cycles and public transport on the ground where people can live a quality life, and then address the health service. Like, why are people saying, oh, yeah, we could see that for emergencies or whatever? Well, let's invest in our health service and so on, so that the helicopters and the rescue crowds have the resources to do the job. You don't need an unmanned drone doing that, but it just gives you an you know, indication of the priorities in here. It's la-la stuff sometimes.
What are they on about? And then there's also some other talk on Europol lately as well, no?
Well, that's the more serious end. We've had some really big moves in terms of actually beefing up the securitized agenda across Europe. So Europol now, although some people would love to see it being the kind of European FBI with powers to go in and investigate everywhere across Europe, and there's some who are actually looking for that, but most countries and everything say, hang on a minute, one police force is enough. And I think it's important, particularly in the context of the discussions in Ireland now that we had this week about beefing up the powers of the Gardaí. The Irish government is actually proposing that the guards will be given power to go in and search people's houses, and you have to hand over the passwords to your electronic devices. If you don't, you could face, if they ask for it, and they'd have access to all your material. Now, this actually feeds into the Europol agenda, where Europol is presently being reformed to get greater and greater powers to go in some ways, over the heads of member state police forces and to, I suppose, take on a power beyond what they have now, because all they do now is really share information. They don't really initiate stuff. So this is giving them a lot more power. It's given them a lot more access to data. So say that data now that the Irish guards could hoover up, that could then be transferred on to Europol and sit in these big bulk processing data centres. If you like, they're moving in the direction of the type of modus operandi which the NSA have in America, of hoovering up data everywhere, of having it there, which is a massive invasion of privacy. And this is the data of non-suspects. It might be that there was a search done on your house and my husband might be suspected of something, but my computer is lying at home and they take access to my data and all my personal stuff is on that, but I'm not a suspect in any crime. So it's very regrettable, but obviously all the big groups are buying into it. Oh, yes, we need increased European cooperation. And look, it's not very sexy. A lot of people are probably switching off going, oh, my God, how boring. But actually, it has huge civil liberties implications. There is a revolution going on in terms of the powers being given to this trans-European organisation, and nobody is tuning in to the implications of it. And the big groups here are buying into it. They love it. But actually what we're saying is there needs to be a huge oversight. We're against the whole thing, but it's going to go ahead. But we need a lot of protections built in to protect fundamental rights, to have a scrutiny of what their activities are, because they're talking about exchanging data with third countries, with private companies in certain instances. So really scary agenda, actually, you know, and not desirable at all.
Wow, that's absolutely mad.
Yeah.
And in the Foreign Affairs Committee, Mick, you wanted to touch on a few things.
Well, I was just briefly going to touch on And that, an item in foreign affairs and an item on environment. And both of them were related to climate and things. Like one of them, for example, at the Environment Committee, we were discussing, environmentally proofing trade deals, right? And obviously, it's a space that they're not really keen on going. They're still looking, they still think that Mercosur is a good idea, and that if we don't, I mean, they literally made the argument that without the likes of Mercosur, they have no stick to put manners on Brazil. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. Mm. Because put manners on them and control them. I mean, in actual fact, if we agree with Mercosur, what we're saying is to Brazil, go ahead and cut down more of the forest of the Amazon so that you can produce more food, more meat for us, and we'll sell you cars in return and we'll all be very happy. That's literally what they're saying. But then on top of that, there was a debate, there was an argument came up during the same debate about, oh, if we're doing trade deals with Africa now, are we going to make sure that illegal migrants issue has been dealt with? In other words, we won't buy stuff or sell stuff to you unless you make sure that there's no illegal migrants coming out of your country and getting to Europe. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I said to the commission, I said, do you not think that if we're serious about putting an end to the problem of illegal migration, why don't we start working towards preventing our large corporations and companies from exploiting these people in the first place so that they have to leave their own land to go survive somewhere else and make a living somewhere else? And the response from the commission was shocking. They actually said back that, well, listen, now, if we look at this geopolitically, our primary ambition must be to come up with something that will challenge the Chinese narrative in the area. Mother of God, I thought it was absolutely shocking. And then on foreign affairs, right, they were talking about making the military more climate friendly and making them more compliant with environmental standards and issues and all. And they said even, we think now, another excuse to beef up the military industry, right? They said, and armies, they said, we think now that we need to get involved more in emergencies like environmental catastrophes, like flooding, for example, they said. They said, so the military have really got to get involved in flooding. I mean, this is absolute nonsense. So I said to him, I said, tell me, I said, in Ireland, I said, we often get flooding, I said, we get a fair bit of rain in Ireland, I said, we often get flooding. But we've people, experienced people working in local authorities to deal with it. I said, do you think that we should lay them off and get the army to do it? I said, we have a small army, but we don't need it to be any bigger. But I'll tell you what we do need, I said. We need our army to be paid properly because they're not being paid properly and they have a big problem holding on to members because the working conditions are terrible and the pay is terrible. So I said, if we're going to invest in our army, don't make it any bigger. Don't be buying them any equipment, but give them proper wages and give them proper working conditions. But I said, don't replace the people in the local authorities on things like flooding. I said, that's just absolute nonsense. Mm. But I mean, they're literally bending over backwards to make the military even bigger than it is. And I said to him, I said, if we're serious about reducing the carbon footprint of the military, we should start by reducing the size of it. Mm-hmm. The Americans have 800 military bases worldwide and as an entity is the biggest polluter on the planet. And that's before they drop a bomb on anybody. And they do drop more bombs than the rest of the world put together each year. And they destroy more homes than the rest of the world put together. But so listen, I mean, they talk out of the two sides of their mouth.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, we're just finishing up. But just before we go, Joe Biden was in town.
He told me to shut up because we're running out of time. And now it's really because Damien wants to talk more.
No, so Joe Biden was in town in Brussels.
He's a typical fucking Brussels bureaucrat at this stage.
I just want to finish on the fact that people back home might be interested to know that Brussels was shut down the other day because Joe Biden was here after the G7 summit and he came to have a conference with Ursula von der Leyen and some high EU representatives. Did you follow it?
I had a detour on my way into the parliament because he was staying in a hotel called The Hotel.
The Hotel, yeah.
Right? And
I never
seen so many police in the one area in my life. Barbed wire.
They made it obvious.
Cars, it was unreal. I mean, you have to give credit to the Belgian police. They pulled out all the stops to protect a war criminal. A fucking war criminal.
Well, they were only following what the Irish police and Irish state did when Obama came to town.
Another war criminal. Imagine. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And that's, we can't protect the ordinary citizens.
Yeah. Sinn Féin. Anyway, that's it. Grazie for listening. And we have to pick our country for next time. So pick the country there, Mick. You get to pick the country.
Again? He's picking again? Oh, I tell you this.
Estonia.
We did.
We did Estonia. How did that get back in the bag?
That's been done.
Well, so you've been minding the bag, so you obviously haven't done a great job.
I'll pick it. Slovakia.
Are they in the EU? I've never heard of anybody from Slovakia.
I watched our match the other night, and they played really well. It was a bit of a surprise. That they won, but they beat Poland, and they were really good.
Well, I've never come back across Slovakia.
Hamšík, who spent most of his life with Napoli, was one of their star players, and Skriniar, who now plays for Inter Milan, is their number one defender. Good side.
Okay, you can end by saying, who's the best Italian footballer ever in the history of the universe?
There's just too many of them to mention.
Okay. Sweet.
Ciao.
Arrivederci.